Philip Plesnik has no cause to be grateful. We are all his debtors, and that includes my father, too. In 1789, when John Adams was the vice president, he wrote once, he said, "My country has in its wisdom contrived for me the most insignificant office that ever the invention of man contrived or his imagination conceived." Apparently, John Adams was unfamiliar with the office of state treasurer. I won't mention the office of lieutenant governor. But all that, of course, is now changed. The course of events has thrust upon our vice president responsibility of a magnitude which our founding fathers could never have conceived. And the mark of one man has given that office powers over the affairs of men which range from the control of outer space to the exploration of our ocean's floors. As mayor of Minneapolis, as a United States senator, as vice president of the United States, and all his countless public endeavors, Hubert Humphrey has brought a touch of warmth, a careful blend of realism and idealism, a relentless devotion to the welfare of all, especially the underdog, and energies which only a pure heart and high purpose could generate. In the midst of appalling pressures, in times of cynicism and indifference, he has always shared with another of his predecessors, Thomas Jefferson, a boundless enthusiasm for the possibilities of reason and progress. He shares, too, with Thomas Jefferson, a conviction that excellence is the heart of the democratic hope, the animating ideal toward which it is forever groping. Hubert Humphrey has always exemplified that excellence. This friend of all mankind is a constant reassurance to a sometimes skeptical world that America is still true to the purpose expressed by its founding fathers. You know all of this. You know him too as a good friend of Israel. I know Hubert Humphrey as my father's dear friend. They were friends. They were also companions in many causes. Now Hubert Humphrey is a friend and an inspiration too to another generation of Stevensons. It's with a great deal of pride, it's a great privilege to give you, ladies and gentlemen, the Vice President of the United States.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Adelaide. It gladdens my heart and warms my spirit to say thank you, Adelaide. I have said it many times, and tonight I say it with the same fullness of gratitude and appreciation that I have to his father. I must say, however, that my good friend Adlai III's father once said to me that And he said to you, because I happened to be present on the occasion when many of you were there, that flattery is all right if you don't inhale it. And I noticed that Bill Malden was looking at me every moment that Adlai was introducing me, and when I got up, he said, "Why were you breathing so deeply?" Now I'm going to explain to you why that was the case. I listened to our illustrious friend, this distinguished statesman, your fellow citizen, ambassador, public servant, civic spirit, Phil Klutznik, speak here. Now, what an act to follow. How would you like to be Hubert Humphrey? I know why the Constitutional Fathers designed the office of Vice President, to give anyone that had any brashness or arrogance a true spirit of humility. And I surely have had a dose of it tonight. But I guess this is what they call character building. And I can stand all of it. And I'm grateful. Now, I have a whole list of things here. You know, my speech could have been within the, well, within reasonable limits of the Herb Kupcinet formula tonight. Of course, he knows that I do stretch that a little bit. But there are several reasons why it's not going to be. First of all, myself. I'm not going to let it be. Secondly, I sat in the chair of Barnett Hodes, and he isn't here, so I take his time. Thirdly, I've kept the watch on every other speaker that's been here, and they have sacrificed a few moments here and there according to my clock, and I'm the only one that kept time. And then there's other things that I should observe. I have time for rebuttal tonight to the mayor of Chicago. It's wonderful to be mayor of this city, and I want to go on record right now. I know that he's the greatest mayor in the United States of America. But just to be known as Mayor Richard Daley is honor enough for anyone, but to be called Mayor Ben-Gurion Richard Daley, I think that's going an extra step. Dick, I want you to know about, just a word about baseball. I, like most people, have my home team. But because I am Vice President of the United States, I take a national point of view on the American League and an American point of view about the National League. But I have already been able to receive an assurance from the distinguished mayor of this city that if the White Sox are the American League pennant winners, and he took exception to the word if in that when I mentioned it to him, that I will have a seat. He said that it would be in the box with the Twins in the dugout. I'm going to take this up with Eddie Stanky. Not long ago, the manager of the team said, when they asked him about the vice president, he said, "Humphrey, who's he? He can't hit." And I promised the mayor of this city that I would use my good offices in case that the Twins should triumph. But we came here for other business. Lieutenant Governor Sam Shapiro. Now, you've had to bear enough, it seems to me, of burden and trouble, Sam, without being called the Hubert Humphrey of Springfield. But I'll say this, Sam, that when the boss is out of town, we do take over, don't we? Ah, there are some happy moments in being number two. I would have thought that Bill Malden might have mentioned Avis when he was talking about that car, when he had the lieutenant governor and the vice president, but he just had to rub it in and get number one, you know. Happy, don't you complain to Jules about that either. There's so much here. I want to pay my respects to the two congressmen, of course, that are with us tonight, Congressman Yates and Congressman Paczynski. I think both of you would like to know that they have asked for a free ride back to Washington tonight. which I intend to provide for them. Which you provide for them. I forgot to mention that. And when a rabbi can be changed into a general and be called beloved all at once, that's going some. Now, in a more serious vein, I was particularly touched with the remarks, indeed the address, of Dr. Feldman. Let me tell you why. Not only because he gave us a vision of the complexity of science, the challenge of it, the meaning of it, but because this occasion has taken on for me an extra meaning, and the distinguished scientist has added to it. Tonight, we help endow a chair in developmental biology and cancer research. It was just 2 weeks ago tonight that I lost a brother from cancer. So that this chair, this particular endowment, it has a special meaning for me, for you. I might add that it's the scourge of the race, of humankind. One out of every five in this room tonight will be touched by it. One out of every three may lose his life because of it. The study of the human cell, the study of developmental biology, how tremendously important. So, what we're really doing tonight is talking about life-saving. And what more important subject could there be at a time when there's so much violence, so much trouble, so much war, so much loss of life? So the evening is appropriate. The occasion is the right occasion. The man to be honored and who has been honored is indeed the right man. Because I know of very few people that have been able to do more to make life meaningful, to add to the full dimension of a meaningful life than Phil Klutznik. And I surely am happy to be here with him and with his wonderful wife, Ethel, and with their fine family, all of which tells us what this evening is about. The good life, the building of a good life. Now, I haven't had some of the opportunities that some of you have of knowing some of the great people. I didn't know Dr. Chaim Weizmann. I wish I had, but I know of him through his transcendent goodness. I know of his good works and the immortality and the eternity of those good works. It shines through in everything about him. And as I've said from my friend Phil Klutznik, I know of him, of course, as this public-spirited citizen, this great public servant, businessman, scholar, civic spirit, ambassador, a host of things. But I also know one other thing about Phil, that once that you've gained a reputation as a public-spirited citizen, there's no escaping it. And Phil, I want to tell you this is a warning. Because while we honor you tonight, it's only to prepare you for greater sacrifices, I think you ought to understand. But this good man doesn't shirk from the onerous duty or burden of sacrifice. He welcomes it, like the man for whom the Institute was named. I want to quote, too, everybody else is quoting. Dr. Weizmann once said, "The walls of Jericho fell to the sound of shouts and trumpets, but I have never heard of walls being raised that way. They fell with noise, but walls are not built with noise and chatter. They are constructed another way." And I think those words have more meaning today than any other time. They have a very special meaning for us. For in our America, and indeed in this sorry and sick world, this must be the time of the builders. And isn't it wonderful that we honor a builder tonight? that Dr. Weitzman must have been thinking of Phil Klutznick, because walls are raised not by the sounds of shouts and trumpets, but by sacrifice and work and dedication. Now, this must be the time of those who seek neither easy glory nor cut-rate success. This is a time for those who are willing to pay the price of work, of frustration too, and often time of self-discipline to build a city, to build a family, to build a nation, to build a neighborhood, and to build a world where people may live peacefully with one another. That's the task of the builder of today, where human dignity is not a speechmaker's phrase, but is a reality in the daily life of every man. And I happen to think that this is the living testimonial, the living story of America and of Israel. This is what binds us together, as I've said so many times from these platforms. Not the written treaty, but the spirit of the people, the spirit that ties us together. Nation building, that's the spirit of America, and that's the spirit of Israel. Now, what does it take to build a nation? Well, dollars, yes. Factories, yes. Farms, tools, resources. It takes every one of these things and more. But the lesson of Israel and of America is that it takes above all people, and not just people, gifted people, talented people, educated people, proud people, and humble people. People that have a great respect for themselves, which means human dignity, and for their neighbors. People that are filled with faith and hope and a belief in the future. You see, I'm one of these Americans that believes that you can't do anything unless you believe. Franklin Roosevelt once said, I remember these were his final words, and as he was at Warm Springs, Georgia, getting ready to deliver a Jefferson Day message. He never finished that message. But he said in that message to the American people, we must move forward. Well, a lot of people say that. But then he told us how. With a strong and an active faith. That's the difference. That's the difference between greatness and littleness. Now, nation building is not for the weak, nor is it for the timid. And it's not without its uncertainties and possible failures. Today, our nation, indeed our nationhood, is being tested. It's being tested in every American community where strife and pain have shattered the calm of a society grown accustomed to the Late Late Show and even the reassuring hum of the Dow Jones ticker or index. It's being shattered in city after city. It's being tested in the choices that we make in responding to these disruptive events in our city streets. For now, when the many, and I repeat, when the many are well fed, clothed, educated, and housed, and the few are not, when the many walk through open doors and the few are barred, now is a time of testing far more demanding than when the many sought to reach what only the few had achieved. Now is a time when it could all be so easy just to deny in our own hearts the spiritual and ideological precepts which have guided us, to push away social responsibility, to live it up individually and as a nation, and even to reject the ancient prophet's cry and question, am I my brother's keeper? A question never answered in the written word, but only in the lives of each and every one of us. Now is a time when it would be all too easy to forget that we really serve God by serving man. created in His image. By loving our neighbors as ourselves, and as that ancient prophet Micah put it, doing justly and loving mercy and walking humbly before our Maker. But we must not do these things. We must not put away responsibility. We must not deny that we are our brother's keeper. And I have faith that we shall not. And I'm pleased, Adelaide, that you saw fit to introduce me as a sort of a congenital optimist. I am. I said quite privately today, coming in from the plane with your chairman and his lovely Nancy, I said, you know, many people accuse me of being overly optimistic. I said, well, I'll tell you why. There are so many people that are working the precincts of pessimism, and there is so few people that live in this vast uninhabited area of optimism, I staked out that claim for myself. You need some optimists today, and history, I think, is on my side, at least American history, Israel's history. Now, there isn't any more repugnant word in my mind in our vocabulary than this word, the ghetto, or ghetto. The very sound of it sickens me. And its inference is one that offends our senses. I have often said that if no other reason that we should eliminate the ghetto is because it doesn't belong in our language. Too many people have had to suffer its indignity at home and abroad. Yet we must recognize that there are ghettos, even in America today, every bit as real as those of the past in other places. And within these ghettos, our ghettos, live fellow Americans whose world is so far distant from yours and mine to be unrecognizable. They're like foreigners that have never even heard of America. Yet until those Americans can really stand with us in unity, and we with them, and feel that we are of the same family, our nation will remain unbuilt. The task of America is incomplete. It will remain only one more blueprint, one more of history's uncompleted frameworks. So this is the work for builders. This is why I said the theme of the night is appropriate, life-giving, building, creation, and we honor a man who symbolizes all of this in his everyday life. This is the work for those in America who want to be where the action is. And this is the task for those who look beyond the country club veranda to the nation that we need to build for the 21st century, which is only 33 years away. We're in the last third of the 20th century. For the time has long passed, my fellow Americans, here in America, just as it has in the world at large, when trickle-down prosperity, trickle-down education, trickle-down opportunity, trickle-down social progress will be enough to satisfy men and women who see on television and hear on transistor radios what the outside world has to offer. There is no place to hide, and you can hide nothing any longer. The television and the transistor radio, and soon the communication satellite, will expose the whole world to each and every human being. The contrast will be there vivid and sharp. And the only way that I know to preserve the tranquility and peace of the world is to see to it that the incredible differences are somehow narrowed. So we're going to have to practice what we've been preaching. We'll have to reach out, for example, to the one American in six or seven who lives on the margins of the general well-being of this nation. Not reaching out to give him welfare, but opportunity. We shall have to make that extra effort for that six-year-old child who comes to school from three generations of illiteracy, ignorance, and discouragement. We shall have to give him the best, not half best, but the best that the school has to offer, or another generation of Americans will be lost. We shall have to make room in our offices, in our factories, our shops, and our business training programs, and in our trade unions, for the willing but untrained young men and women who will never be able to go back to school, who do not have the standard prefabricated credentials for the world of work. Or those young men and women will be lost for time to come to the world of welfare, relief, and crime. And might I add that those of us who are more fortunate have a great stake in seeing that those who are less fortunate have a chance. Now, all of us will therefore have to re-examine our old ways of doing things. We must, in other words, continue to build a better America, to build a freer America, and to build a more just America. Now, I could document my case, but the hour is late. You've heard me speak of this before, and I speak of it with sincere and deep conviction, because I think that there is a great struggle going on in our country, and we have to win it. The struggle for one nation, and a struggle for one nation under God. To see that it is indivisible, and that it provides liberty and justice for all. That's what nation building is about in America. And we're making progress. Don't be discouraged. The fact that we're being tested brings the best out of us, if we will but let it be. That spark that was spoken of here a moment ago by Phil, that spark of the soul, of divine providence, of goodness that is there, it can be fanned into the flame that consumes the evil and provides for the creation of something new and better. Now let me add a few words finally about this process of nation building in the larger world environment in which we live. You know, when we think of nation building, of course our minds turn to many countries. I mentioned America and, of course, to Israel. We think of the work of the Weizmann Institute because science and technology and education are fundamental to nation building. You cannot be both free and ignorant, said Thomas Jefferson. You have to make a choice. We made it here, Israel has made hers. Free, which means banishing ignorance, which means rejecting prejudice and bigotry and discrimination. We think of the efforts of the United States and Israel and other have nations, the efforts that they've undertaken in this post-World War world to help the have-nots. And I was so pleased to hear the Consul General tonight mention once again what Israel is doing in her technical assistance program, in her foreign aid program. We've spoken of it many times, but we need to remember it, because that is the symbol of great success. Yet, since this seems to be an evening for fact-facing, I think we maybe ought to put some of the facts in their proper perspective. Pope Paul VI, in his recent and historic encyclical, and by the way, I visited for almost an hour with His Holiness about that encyclical last April. We went over it in great care, and he gave me a copy autographed in Latin. And then he said, I thought maybe that you might want one in English too. I didn't tell him that I'd studied 4 years of Latin, but had forgotten most of it. But in that historic encyclical, there was a line that I want to leave with you, because every person in this room is interested in peace. And we talk about it, but I remember again what Chaim Weizmann said, it isn't the shouting and the noise that builds, it tears down, but doesn't build. The Pope said, development is the new name for peace. Development. His predecessor, that peasant priest, Pope John the 23rd, said that where there is constant want, there is no peace. I don't think two more profound statements have been made in our century. One where there is constant want, there is no peace. Poverty is the enemy of peace. Hunger is the enemy of peace. Ignorance is the enemy. And then the answer by the predecessor, where Pope Paul said, development is the new name for peace. And if peace is indeed to be preserved in this nuclear age, then every industrialized nation, all of the more affluent, fortunate nations, regardless of ideology, east or west, will have to mount a far greater effort in international nation building than they have today. When I think of the unbelievable waste of the arms race, and when I think what man could do if he but could live at peace. Now, if our rich and powerful nation is challenged by the gap that exists within our own society between rich and poor, this industrialized world in general is challenged even more by the sickening and ever-widening gap that divides the rich from the poor. The 2/3 of the world's people who live hungry, desperate, and ready to turn to anyone who offers food, hope, and answers. And if our American ingenuity is being tested in meeting our domestic trials, I suggest it is all the more being tested in the task of peaceful development around the world. I need point no further than the Middle East to bring clearly into focus the seething turmoil that can stem from the societies of poverty, victimized by fear and suspicion, fed by ignorance and despair. That was at the root cause, much of it, of the struggle in the Middle East against the state of Israel. Yet in that same Middle East, we see a noble example of nation building, showing what can be done. Nation building by men and women who, in the spirit of our own American forefathers, have pledged for their country and themselves, their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to the creation and the defense of a free and independent Israel. And today, the story of Israel inspires hundreds of millions of people all over the world. Israel, in peace and war, commands respect. And might I say that respect in a world of nations is even more valuable than just having somebody say friend. Yet Israel knows, and her neighbors should know, that the hope of a better life in peace and freedom requires more than arms, more than military strength, more than military victories. It requires regional cooperation and massive development of all the resources of the area, the entire area. And I think I need point no further in the Middle East to demonstrate the urgent need for the application of advanced knowledge and technology that we and others possess in the cause of peaceful development. Let me give you an example. The Middle East needs water desperately. What is more the symbol of peace and life than water? Indeed, water itself to the prophet Amos was his symbol of justice. For the past 3 years, our government and the government of Israel have been working together in planning for a massive installation which would use nuclear energy to desalt seawater. Right now, we are concerned with the practicality and the cost of a plant which would produce over 100 million gallons a day of desalted water from the sea and produce at the same time 300 megawatts. That's 300 million watts of electrical power. Other studies are underway for application in other parts of the world. You may remember, I think it was 3 years ago, that President Johnson, speaking to a Weizmann Institute dinner in New York, as I recollect, had these words to say. If the nations of the Middle East will turn towards the works of peace, they can count with confidence upon the friendship and help of the people of the United States. We here will do our share and do more to see that the peaceful promise of nuclear energy is applied to the critical problem of desalting water and helping to make the deserts bloom. My friends, that promise was made and it is now being kept. Two eminent Americans, very eminent, President Eisenhower and Admiral Strauss, have put forth another such proposal in the same spirit. This proposal and others like it, which might contribute to the development in the Middle East and elsewhere, are receiving sympathetic, careful attention within our government. Now, I use the Middle East and the desalinization of water as example of the challenges and of the hard practical work which lie ahead. Because it's easy to talk about making the deserts bloom, and it is so exciting to think about what we can do with science and technology. In my work as chairman of the Space Council and chairman of the Marine Sciences Council, I'm brought in close contact with these thrilling, exciting possibilities. But I must tell you that it isn't all so easy. Assume, for instance, that the ultimate of regional cooperation might be achieved in the Middle East, where everybody sat down and agreed. Assume that the ultimate in private development might be obtained. Then assume that the state of the technological art already existed to economically, cheaply undertake these projects that I've spoken of. What would be the result? You would still be astounded by the cost, the time, and the commitment of resources that would be necessary to even bring the projects or to bring these projects into full operation. And it would take many months, in fact, it'll take years before the benefits could really come down to the people and the deserts be brought to bloom. Now, friends, that's the fact that I've told you. Is this any reason to lose heart? Is this any reason to give up on desalinization? I think not. To the contrary, it is a reason for all of us to realize that the time is growing short and that the scope of the challenge of development must be acknowledged by those who have to meet it and get on with the business. That's why I was so disappointed this year when I saw the President's foreign aid program emasculated by certain forces in our Congress. We saw a good deal of the hatchet work being done by some of the same people who in the same breath decried the necessity of our involvement in unfamiliar parts of the world. And to cut off foreign aid is to leave the field to disorder and poverty, and is to invite trouble, more trouble, in unfamiliar parts of the world. Yes, the Pope was right. Development is the new name for peace. Without development, there is no peace. And without resources, commitment, science, and technology, without dinners like this, without the Weizmann Institute, without our government working hand in hand with others, there is no development. And there is no peace. And this is where the builders come in. Everyone, I hope, or at least all men, profess to seek peace. But peace is like a tender flower. It needs a fertile soil in which to grow, and this is just as true in America as it is elsewhere. Peace cannot, and I say it will not, grow in the rocks of bitterness and poverty, in the dry sands of backwardness and despair. It needs the fertile soil of education, the Weizmann Institute. Education in America, vast investments in research, science, and technology. It needs the fertile soil of food, the abundance that can come from the deserts that bloom. And it needs the fertile soil of health, of a people, and of a mind, and a body, and a spirit. And above all, peace needs the hope of those who long for it. The pursuit of peace resembles the building of a great cathedral. It is the work of generations. Who knows better than those gathered at this dinner tonight? In concept, it requires a master architect. In execution, it necessitates the labors of many. Yes, the pursuit of peace requires time. But I submit that we must use time not as a crutch, but as a tool, an instrument of construction not a couch of slumber. We must use time to see that our own country and the world, to see our own country and the world as they really are, to measure what needs to be done, and then to be willing to do it unafraid. And then, as Dr. Weitzman said, without the shouts or the trumpets, and with only the rewards that lie within our own hearts, we must build Plutznik-like, build block by block, brick by brick, country by country, neighborhood by neighborhood, a cathedral of peace and justice and brotherhood that can stand as a monument to man's goodness for 1,000 years. It's to this high purpose that good men are called, and they become the better for the calling. And it's to this high purpose that this dinner was dedicated, to a good man that has answered the calling. Thank you.